Good morning, family of God. This is Sharon Chubbuck, and it's my privilege to share with you today. When Renee asked me to teach about a month ago, she suggested the topic liturgy. I wasn't sure I had anything to share, but I decided to give it a try and actually found the topic fascinating. But let's start with a liturgy joke. An Episcopalian priest was invited to preach at New Covenant. He greeted our congregation and said, "Please turn in your liturgy to..." The people looked at him in confusion. "Oh, I'm sorry," he said. I should have said, "Please turn in your bulletin to the order of service." Liturgies, formal and informal, are everywhere, including New Covenant. And we've been developing it for 50 plus years. My earliest thoughts about liturgy weren't very positive. Chants, incense, candles, centuries-old prayers from saints, hand gestures, and a lot of rote recitation of words that probably didn't mean much to anybody anymore. I grew up in an evangelical church, a fundamentalist church, and we didn't do liturgy. We didn't believe in saints. We're all saints, right? And we didn't believe in ancient prayers written centuries ago and prayed in unison. Oh no, we prayed individual, spontaneous prayers in the present. We didn't need a pantheon of saints to talk to God for us. We must not have realized when the Psalms were written and who wrote them. And honestly, we rather smugly assumed we were better Christians precisely because we didn't follow a liturgy. There's a lot of emphasis on individualism in those attitudes. Salvation and spirituality, private affairs. A lot of dualism. We're either right or wrong with no shared middle ground. And a lot of strong division, a clear us-them separation. Happily, I managed to leave most of that judgmentalism behind as I grew older, but I still had little interest in liturgies. And then in 2001, God sent Judson and me to Milwaukee, where I spent 23 years teaching at Marquette University, a Jesuit university. And we attended a Catholic church for several years in a parish called Three Holy Women, which immediately appealed to me, with a priest, Father Tim, who was really remarkable. In fact, it's safe to say that the entire 23 years I was there, the vast majority of my spiritual nurturing and growth came from Jesuits and Catholic priests, in retreats, spiritual direction, instruction, and yes, in liturgies. It was an extremely positive experience, and thinking back on it in preparing this teaching has stirred up a lot of happy memories. But I understand that not everyone shares my enthusiasm for liturgy. A Marquette student lived with us for a year, and when we told her how much we were enjoying the Catholic Mass, she said, "Sharon, you can enjoy the liturgy of the Catholic Mass because you didn't grow up with it. You didn't go to Catholic schools. You don't have the baggage I have." Point well taken. I appreciate that all people's responses will be different. But this is my story. And in sharing it with you, I hope you can see how wide and varied liturgies are and how we can find God in liturgy when we engage with them openly and wholeheartedly. But first, a little context. The word liturgy originates from leto, which means public and common, like common folks, the laity, like all of us. And urga, meaning work, like an erg is a measure for a unit of work or energy. Put them together, liturgy. It can be described as an order of communal public actions done by the common people and sometimes for the common folks when they are gathered together in secular or religious context. The liturgy is the entire package of that gathering, and the traditions, repeated rituals, movements, stories, songs, food, and so on are the specific things that make up the liturgy. In Jewish liturgies, which early Christians would have participated in, the tabernacle and the temple were full of symbols, prayers, actions, postures, as people gathered to honor God's presence. Later, as followers of Jesus met on their own, liturgy focused on Jesus' command at the Last Supper to do this in remembrance of me. It moved from a shared, informal agape meal to the more standardized liturgy, and as early as 1590s, liturgy focused on the Eucharist, what we call communion. You see, I believe that liturgies are how people pass on their traditions, their culture, their history, their values to the next generation in both secular and sacred spaces. And liturgies are everywhere. Stories repeated around campfires, holiday celebrations with the same foods, same songs, same dances, the rituals in weddings and funerals. In church services, liturgies can include art, like Stations of the Cross, Renaissance paintings, music, psalms and hymns, prayers, both ancient and modern, drama and movement, doing the Emmanuel dance during Advent, crossing ourselves, standing, kneeling, raising hands. We can engage these liturgies on autopilot, rote memorization, or we can engage mindfully, attending with our entire being, rational minds and emotions, aesthetic sensibilities, our very physical bodies. All liturgies, I believe, have one common purpose. They are summaries of what we value that form us in one way or another, according to those values. Perhaps one very good definition: liturgy is the labor of a community alongside the prayers, meditations, and rituals that shape us as we gather. God seems to have initiated one of the earliest liturgies in the Passover celebration. After 10 plagues, the Pharaoh of Egypt continued to enslave the children of Israel. And so, as his last act, God struck down the firstborn of all in the land, sparing the Israelites who marked their doorways with the blood of a lamb. This produced their freedom. In the Exodus passage Ruth read for us, God commands a celebration of that event with a liturgy, and it has been practiced ever since. Today we see the liturgy of the Passover story in Seder dinners that are also filled with ritual, prayers, symbols, specific behaviors, even postures. As we read it again, try to put yourself in the passage. Or if you've been to a Seder, try to put yourself in this modern version of the liturgy. What do you notice? What do you wonder? God told Moses, "Tell the Israelite people, on the 10th day of the first month, they must take a lamb for each household, a flawless male. And at twilight on the 14th day of this month, the whole assembled Israelite community should slaughter their lambs. They should take some of the blood and smear it on the two doorposts and on the beam over the door of the houses in which they are eating. That same night, they should eat the meat roasted over the fire. They should eat it along with unleavened bread because they were in a hurry to escape, and bitter herbs because it had been such a horrific experience. This is how you should eat it. You should be dressed with your sandals on your feet and your walking stick in your hand. You should eat the meal in a hurry. It is the Passover of the Lord. I'll pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I'll strike down every oldest child in the land of Egypt, both human and animals. I'll impose judgments on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be your sign on the houses where you live. Whenever I see the blood, I'll pass over you. No plague will destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. This day will be a day of remembering for you. You will observe it as a festival to the Lord. You will observe it in every generation as a regulation for all times." What do we notice? What do we wonder? This liturgy was done communally, not individually. It reenacted a shared history, a drama, and it involved their entire being, moving, eating, standing, remembering, praying, speaking, singing. It created a community where they belonged, past, present, and even future, as they shared the story with their children. And I wonder, how did remembering what God had done for them affect these people? Were they encouraged, hopeful, less alone? Do you think celebrating this event every year today, every year, shaped who the people became? You see, the richness of liturgy, the all-encompassing humanity of participating in a liturgy, this one that God Himself instituted. Today, I want to share three ways liturgies are a gift to us: belonging, being held, and becoming. Belonging. When I first came to Marquette, I wasn't always confident I belonged there. At one point, I attended a service in the large cathedral on campus, where a young woman sang the prelude to the service. Her voice was lovely. The music soared majestically up to the rafters. It was truly beautiful. But as I leaned in to enjoy the experience, I realized the lyrics were a recitation of the names of saint after saint after saint. Just that, nothing more. I recoiled. Maybe I didn't belong here spiritually. I think this triggered those old us-them days when venerating saints seemed like a bad thing to do. But as she continued her beautiful recitation of that long list of names, something wonderful happened. I felt like I was caught up in that community of saints. So many people over centuries had loved God and pursued a life of service and compassion. I was emotionally moved by this great cloud of witnesses. They were encouraging me, welcoming me, and I was part of them. That liturgical song folded me into the community of saints and into the community of Marquette. I knew I belonged. Our human need for belonging, for a community, is truly profound. The Israelites experienced belonging in their shared reenactment of the Passover. Today, brothers and sisters of the Jewish faith belong to each other in the Passover Seder dinner. Think about the elements of New Covenant's liturgy. Welcome, songs, prayers, scriptures, teaching, sharing, communion, and more songs. Do any of these, together or alone, create a sense of community for you? Does any part meet that deep human need to belong? Does doing the liturgy together make a difference? Wholeheartedly entering into the elements of our liturgy together with saints of old, with psalms written and sung thousands of years ago, and with the people right next to you in this present moment, that creates community that transcends time and space. The first gift of liturgy surely is belonging. The second gift of liturgy is being held when we simply can't hold on much longer by ourselves. When despair or fear or depression weigh too heavily for us to hold our faith. A young Black woman who's the author of a book called African American Liturgies describes her experience. At age 23, she walked into an Episcopal church on the verge of suicide. As she heard people reciting the liturgy in unison, she first felt defiance. They're mindlessly reciting words like zombies. But then she felt a complicated relief as the words became clearer. Blessed be God. Blessed be God's kingdom now and forever. She describes how these communal prayers touched her in her depression. In her words, the independence of personal prayer required more imagination than I could access at that time. Trying to articulate love, hope, beauty, and even more dangerously, lament, was like trying to float with weights hanging around my neck. Liturgy, I found, was kind of like rest. For the first time, my presence in a spiritual place didn't depend on my articulation or imagination. I could rise or sit and kneel and speak or not speak in this sacred theater that others had written the script for. I could let others hold a sacred imagination for me. To be clear, she explains, the liturgy did not save her. It did not remedy her depression immediately, but it was an anchor that kept her from drifting helplessly in her despair. In her words, ritual coupled with beauty makes for a very adequate mooring. It won't carry you to shore, but it will keep you close enough that hope can swim out to visit you regularly. I love that. So think back to the moments of despair, anger, and fear that we all have known. What words, prayers, scriptures, what songs in the New Covenant liturgy of worship held you when you were sinking without hope? I have a long list of those songs. I cling to them when I feel like I'm flying apart or sinking under the waves. What is this love? How can I keep from singing? I will trust in you and I will not be afraid, among many others, and many from the Catholic liturgies as well. What songs have held you? truly being held is a gift of the liturgy. And last, liturgy helps us become the people God created us to be, now and in the age to come. Our liturgies shape us. They inform our decisions, how we treat others, how we handle money, how we respond to conflict, what we hope for, what we're willing to sacrifice ourselves for the good of the community. I had a small but meaningful experience of this in the Catholic Mass. The congregation recited the prayer, the Lord's Prayer, in unison every week. But Catholics stop at "Deliver us from evil." At that point, Father Tim spoke up. "Yes, Lord, deliver us from all our anxieties." The first time I heard it, it felt like a breath of fresh air that I had been desperate for. Anxiety is my regular companion, and it is a barrier that blocks my journey to becoming the woman God intends me to be, the journey of becoming more like Jesus. Father Tim said it every Sunday, and I found myself eagerly looking forward to that moment and those words because I needed the prayers of this man of God to keep me on track. Deliver us from all our anxieties. The words of the liturgy, repeated weekly, gave me the chance to say yes to becoming more like the person God intends me to be. This may seem simple, but this idea of becoming with liturgy is a deadly serious one. You see, we are not living in a spiritually neutral world. We are immigrants, strangers in a world, though created by God, is under an oppressive rule, the kingdom of darkness, and that oppressive rule is waging war against us becoming like Jesus. 1 Peter says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people who are God's own possession. You have become this people so that you may speak of the wonderful acts of the one who called you out of darkness into his amazing light. Once you weren't a people, but now you are God's people. Once you hadn't received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Dear friends, since you are immigrants and strangers in the world, I urge that you avoid worldly desires that wage war against your lives. Live honorably among unbelievers. Today they defame you as if you were doing evil, but in the day when God visits to judge, they will glorify him because they have observed your honorable deeds." Peter is pretty straightforward with these new believers. They were living under Roman rule, and it was hostile to them and this new religion. The oppression they experienced was real, and he was giving them practical advice for survival. We also live in a world where darkness rules. And just as the liturgies of our faith shape who we are becoming, the kingdom of darkness that's captured our world also has a liturgy to shape us in a different direction. Powerful messages are repeatedly trying to influence our thinking and acting to make us obedient citizens of that kingdom, not God's. Liturgies that valorize greed, envy, lust, divisiveness, abuse of power, dishonesty, selfishness, anger, unforgiveness, vengeance, the list is long. We can't be complacent. There is a battle for our allegiance and for our formation. These liturgies of this dark kingdom are so taken for granted that we don't even realize they are there, tucked away in our government, organized religion, the media, social media, consumerism, how we see the other, how we think about racial equality, and we don't see that they are shaping us, how we see each other, how we even understand God. It's just natural. Yet our stories are braided with the stories of the empire. For example, we are immersed now by utilitarian lies that mask truth, a dualistic outlook. It's right or it's wrong and nothing in between. And you darn well better get it right. Individualism instead of community. Selfishness instead of generosity. Fear instead of trust. Life is transactional, not compassionate servanthood. A definition of success. The one with the most toys wins. Fame, status, wealth, and power. And at this point, the enemy seems to be winning pretty emphatically. Rather than seeking a servanthood to love our neighbors and our enemies, As a Palestinian scholar, Edward Said, said, empire isn't just soldiers and weapons. It's attitudes, ideas, practices, and stories. It's a way of imagining the world. And we are faced with the choice. Which set of liberties, liturgies will we let shape us? Will we be God's people, peacemakers? Will we welcome the stranger, care for the widow and the orphan? Will we love our neighbor as ourself? Will we love our enemies, no exceptions? Will we follow Jesus' model of servanthood? Or will we give over our power to the liturgy of the empire? Paul describes this choice, Romans 12, 1 and 2. So, brothers and sisters, because of God's mercies, I encourage you to present your bodies as a living sacrifice that is holy and pleasing to God. This is your appropriate priestly service, your reasonable sacrifice, and it's the same word that's used for liturgy. Don't be conformed to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds so that you can figure out what God's will is, what is good and pleasing and mature. There are many ways to be conformed to the patterns of this world, and silent, taken for granted liturgies, patterns, if you will, are some of the most powerful. But embracing liturgies of worship, love, service, justice, they're more powerful to transform and renew our minds. They keep us becoming the children of the kingdom. We come now to the most sacred, powerful liturgy of remembrance, communion. Jesus took bread, blessed it, broke it, and said, "Take, eat, do this in remembrance of me." Remembering those we love is not an abstract, idle thought. Remembering weaves the truth of this liturgy into our entire lives. In communion, we remember by acting it out with our bodies, minds, emotions, spirits. It's where we find belonging, where we are held in our weakness, and we continue our journey of becoming God's people. The tables are available, open to us all. Amen.